This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off. Peter Pham is the co-founder of startup studio Science, which is behind many of the world's best consumer internet companies, where they co-build these companies with founders in Santa Monica, California. In this conversation, we discuss the secret art of fundraising, what Science looks for in great companies, why Peter spends so much time networking, how to build a great brand, and the stories behind Dollar Shave Club, Liquid Death, Realblox, and Play Versus. I really enjoyed this conversation with Peter, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. The first is BlockFi. You guys know I'm a huge fan, an investor, and a user. They've got three products. The first, you can deposit crypto and get a US dollar loan. The second, you can buy and sell crypto. Or the third, my favorite, is their interest-bearing account. You can go in and put cash or crypto and earn up to 8.6% APY in this interest-bearing account. Unheard of interest rates compared to the legacy world. So go check them out at BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp. And really take a look at that interest-bearing account. To me, that's the most compelling part about BlockFi. And again, I'm a user and an investor in the company, so really, really believe in what they're doing. BlockFi.com/pomp. Our second sponsor is new. They're called Choice. It's a new self-directed IRA product that I'm really excited about. If you're listening to this, you're likely part of the 7.1 million Bitcoin owners who have retirement accounts with dollars in them, but not Bitcoin. That's right, retirement accounts, dollars, but no Bitcoin. I was in that situation too, but now you can actually buy real Bitcoin in your retirement account. I'm talking about owning your private keys and using tax advantage dollars to do it too. I've got an account at Choice and you should go get one as well. It's an absolute game changer. So head on over to retirewithchoice.com/pomp. Again, retirewithchoice.com/pomp. I got myself an account. It's a no-brainer, a self-directed IRA that allows you to own Bitcoin with tax-advantaged dollars, including your own private keys. Retirewithchoice.com/pomp. Lastly, don't forget that I write a daily letter to over 50,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy-to-understand language while sharing opinions on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com. Again, pompletter.com, or go in the description and you can click on any of the links there. All right, let's get into this with Peter. I hope you guys enjoy it.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. The legend's here. Peter, what's up, man?
What's up?
All right. For the like two people who are listening to this who don't know who you are, what's your background?
Let's see. I'm down here in LA, living in the dream by the beach. I run a small fund in LA called Science. It's a $75 million early stage seed fund attached to a startup studio. Kind of one of the first to do startup studios. Basically means we help start the companies, build them at day zero, usually for 12 to 18 months alongside the founders, figure out kind of what we're doing, why we're doing it, find product market fit. We've been doing that for about 8 years, and about the last 3 years, we've had a fund now attached to it. All consumer internet products and companies, everything from things you've maybe heard of. Dollar Shave Club was one of the first big breakouts. Dog Vacay, which became Rover, Liquid Death, and many other companies. Many failed, some succeeded, and some are on its way.
You're being incredibly humble because you guys have probably one of, if not the most successful startup studio, right? So a lot of accelerators and kind of all these other things that fund and help, but the idea of actually being there from day one and helping create these companies is a little bit different model. You need some different things that you look for. Maybe talk a little bit about, as you guys have been successful over the years, like what does the ideal team idea, how it comes together, like what does that look like through the pattern recognition that you guys have developed?
We're pretty thesis driven. So we have kind of like find these markets that we really want to focus over. So right now, brands, which we've always kind of done particularly well, looking at, you know, what's next on your mobile phone, like what else you can be entertained at other than looking at Instagram and Snapchat. And then the other is, you know, what is the behavior post pandemic, right? What is the, how are we going to behave? What kind of products and services are we going to use? From there, it's just finding the idea that resonates. For me, particularly, it's kind of like music, right? So one of the things is I love to dance. First of all, dance floor is like part of my bio. And just like music, I'm sure all music is great music, right, for two different people. But some things make you dance and some things make you hum. Some things make you like look up the artist, play it over and over, add it to your playlist. Startups are like that for me. I'm sure there's lots of great companies and startups, but when I see the startup that resonates with me, with the founder, and that founder, you know, particularly for us, they want help. They want our opinion. They want to kind of learn. They want to grow with us. That's what I'm looking for. So it's a, look, I'm an all-in type of person. Like if you get to know me, when I'm not, when I'm in, I'm 110% all in, which means I kind of want to feel like I'm a part of it. And so if I'm not authentically just loving it, I'm just going to pass. Not to say it's an indictment on you or the startup or the idea. It's just, I just don't see myself waking up and thinking about it 24 hours a day. So it's a little convoluted, but for me, it's a little bit more gut and instinct. But of course, the founder is everything.
So from the outside looking in, and I've seen a number of deals that you guys have done over time, each of them has kind of some differences, but there is the commonality of there's almost this like cult-like following behind some of the brands. And so Liquid Death and Dollar Shave Club are probably two great examples of that. Maybe talk a little bit about the Dollar Shave Club story and kind of how do you take a business which at the outset, for most people, the first time they heard about it was this wild video that the CEO is featured in, to all of a sudden, within a number of years, it's a $1 billion exit. Like, how does that happen? And what's going on behind the scenes that you guys are doing to help kind of really help that team become that successful?
You know, that is always going to be the vision and the genius of Michael Dubin, right? He is, when I met him the first time, I just thought to myself, this is one of the most creative persons I've ever met. He's Branson 30 years ago, right? Just brand creative. Like if you think about what Branson's beyond able to take the Virgin brand and create multiple things each and every time and then just understand culture, that was a big part of it. The other was that, of course, that look, razor blades, everyone loves to hate it. So there are certain things in the world people love to hate. Right. So the other example, Uber worked because everyone loved to hate taxis. Like you could just walk up to somebody like taxis. What a pain in the ass. Like, don't you hate it? Yes. Razor blades at the time, Gillette, it's like you had to shave. You had to buy their $30 razor blades and you could walk up to anybody and say, can you believe they're ripping us off? Don't you kind of hate it? Yes. So there's that's part of it. Then it's how you approach it and market with that and use that virality. It was funny. It was the first kind of opening when YouTube started taking off in Facebook. So this is, gosh, it's almost 8 years ago when we launched, right? 8.5. At the time, we were one of the first people ever to use YouTube as a lead generation, run a viral video to an advertisement. That was the first. Using Facebook in the commenting section and using the creative as an ad unit and using the comment section and creating virality through that. So it was a combination of timing, right, based on marketing tactics that you can have reach with people and understanding that word of mouth. It's like this thing that we've been hurt, you know, ever since college, like you would hear about word of mouth, but 8 years ago, it was the first time when you knew that 100 people could be heard by 1,000 to 10,000 to 1,000,000 people all through Facebook, all through YouTube. So that was a big part of it.
So you go from that, which is many people will say, that's great, Peter, but that kind of window of time has passed, right? And those have become commoditized to now something like Liquid Death, which has a lot of the same kind of features, if you will, yeah. the first time I saw it, you literally were taking pictures, posting it all over the internet. And I was like, what is he doing? And at first, it almost was like a joke at first. And then I think at South by Southwest, maybe you were handing out cans, right? And then a couple other conferences, like, oh wait, this is like a real thing. And the second that you put the can in your hand and realize like there's magic here, right? I don't know what it is, whatever. We ended up putting a very small check in alongside you guys kind of taking this really what sounds like was an idea and a brand and now scaling it out to what it's become. So like, how do you recreate the magic of Dollar Shave Club with a different product, different brand? Is there a formula to it, or is it just kind of, again, moment in time, different tactics?
Same strategy, different kind of platform. So Facebook's programmatic at this point. Now we're talking Instagram, Snapchat, but really Instagram. So think about visual. For me, when I heard about it, it was the moment when we had just started banning plastic straws, right? So there's always, to me, there's this meta thing culturally that's happening. And as investors, we're supposed to kind of not tell the future, but like for me this early, hey, what's going to be culturally relevant 12 to 18 months from now? Right, in 12 to 18 months, so it's been, Liquid Death has been about, it's June, so about 14 months in or so when we launched, but I saw it a year and a half ago. At that time, we just banned plastic straws. And I thought, huh, plastic straws, the social spread of how we are becoming a little bit more aware of the environment, how the whale is, you know, washing ashore with 90 pounds of plastic in its belly, right? And people are starting to talk about plastic. I thought, well, maybe plastic water bottles. Like, I've always thought it's kind of gross. Like, that's you. And then you look at the data. It's unbelievable how much plastic bottles are happening. Then there was this Atlantic article about 2 years ago that said China stopped buying our trash. So, well, wait a minute. So if China's not buying our trash to recycle anymore, we just banned plastic straws. I thought there would be this movement, honestly, about now. It happened a lot earlier than I expected, where plastic bottles are going to be kind of the cigarette butt of our generation. Like, if you see somebody smoking a cigarette, you're like, really? It's not as culturally okay these days. And then I don't drink. I'm actually allergic to alcohol. And for a very long time, I would always like holding a can. This feels just natural. And then lastly, it's content. If we've noticed during this pandemic, are you opening up Instagram as often? It's kind of boring, it turns out. Like, nobody's doing anything. Content, people want something to talk about. Holding a can of Liquid Death in person, someone's gonna walk up to you and say, hey, what's that? I will guarantee it 100 times, someone's gonna do it. And ultimately, people go to bars, people go to parties to talk to other people, but turns out, not everyone's like you or me, who's an extrovert. Most people are an introvert. And to give somebody something to talk about that is universal, kind of like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, don't you hate plastic water bottles? Yes, again, that goes back to like universally, we all love to hate plastic water bottles, right? And in a lot of cases, drinking alcohol is a peer pressure environment. And this kind of eases that environment and gives you something to talk about. So it's a lot of conversation. And so it's going back to what you're saying, you're using the same tactics. Give something for somebody to talk about. Dollar Shave Club, funny, viral video. Like, I can't believe it's that they charge $30. This is $6. What a deal. Disruption was mailing something to your house on a subscription 8.5 years ago. This didn't exist. We were the first company. I asked the Collison brothers to create a recurring payment system on Stripe that didn't exist. Right. We like it was kind of this is before Shopify. This is before everything that makes it so easy to click and subscribe to things. Now for Liquid Death, it's just content. And now you're saying, well, we have almost 100,000 Instagram fans. What's the content? 25 people got tattoos. Someone just got married with it. Like, we made a heavy metal album with it. It's content and people just want to talk about it. So it's all about marketing, ultimately.
Part of what cracks me up too, specifically around Liquid Death, is the haters marketed as well, right? They're literally like, I remember when the articles came out about the fundraise, like people were like, this is the dumbest thing ever, right? And you're like, I appreciate you sharing that article. Like, thank you. You just drove sales.
Well, we talked about this. It emboldens everybody else. So look, you see it in politics, right? And you see it in product, which is people, there's going to be 10% of the population who hate everything they see. And just for whatever reason, this offended a lot of people. I don't know why, but it just offended people. And those people called everybody else who liked it or thought it was cool an idiot, dumb, whatever name calling you can possibly hurl at it. That made everybody else say, you know what? I'm not dumb. I'm not a dumb consumer. Like, screw you. I'm all in. And this goes to, if you look at politics today, when you, on one end, you just call blatantly anybody who disagrees with you an idiot. It turns out it emboldens and it takes all the people who are moderate to pick a side. And generally, when you're in the middle and you're like, really no opinion, do you go with the person who called you an idiot? Or do you go with the side that you're kind of already on? Typically, it's on this side. So yeah, some of our best performing ads right now on Liquid Death are hate ads. So the heavy metal album was called The Greatest Hates.
That's what cracks me up though, right? Is like actually the brand has embraced the haters and shares, yeah, like here's the best hateful comments, and which makes people just laugh, right? And you actually see like Jeff Bezos right now is embracing this as well. He's taking customer emails who are backlash against him supporting Black Lives Matter, and he's posting them on Instagram and being like, you're a customer I'm happy to lose. Right. And people almost kind of gravitate towards that.
Oh, because fans of it who can identify, just like you've made lifelong fans. Right. And that, look, there's the big difference. I won't compare the two. Right. One is doing the right thing and saying, look, I have an opinion. And if you don't share with me, you know, best of luck. This is when I think about marketing, haters will always hate. You can't convince them otherwise. But to me, when you start hurling insults, that's use those, because at the end of the day, like I'm sure you, I don't know, I love you. I'm sure many people, but I'm sure you have haters and I have haters. It is what it is. Like I don't live my life to seek approvals from everybody else. If you did that, that's a sad life, right? Like do good things, celebrate your wins and ignore the haters. That's what they say.
I can back up the fact that you saying that you are the first on the dance floor is actually a fact. I have literally been with Peter when he has been like, hey, nobody's on the dance floor. I will be the first. And within 20 minutes, there's a dance party every single time.
You know what? It's funny. When I think about why I do that, I like bringing joy. Like it's there's something about dancing where most people who stand around dance floor, like they want, like they would dance, but they're a little bit self-conscious. And for me, I'm like, if you just let go and just let yourself have fun, you'll notice everybody else will just join you. And there's no more judgment when everybody's doing it, right? Well, as soon as everybody's doing something, no judgment. But if one person does it, all of a sudden, it's like, well, should I? And I think dancing is one of those liberating moments where you can kind of let go of what you're thinking about. Work disappears out of your mind. There's a little bit of freedom. There's this endorphin hit of just joy and happiness. Like you'll never see a dance floor going off where there's sadness. Like it's just, and so to me, it's a challenge to walk into a wedding, a party, a business event and just get the dance floor. It's for me, it's a challenge because it's marketing, right? So what am I doing? I'm walking around really one by one trying to sell people to do something. And to me, that's just like, it helps me kind of tune the senses around like, how do you convince people to do something that's slightly out of their comfort range, but I know they want to do it. And as soon as they do it, they're going to enjoy themselves. That's like, to me, it's a psychological experiment.
My favorite thing that anyone's ever said to me about you is either South by Southwest or Puerto Rico. Somebody came up to me and they said, man, Peter's really drunk. And they didn't know who you were, right? They were just like, oh, this guy's like hammered. I was like, no, Peter doesn't drink. Like that's him 24/7. Like he's just a happy dude, right? And he's going to get the dance party started. And I almost looked at it as like, it was such a compliment, right? They didn't realize that, but it was like a thing where, oh, somebody who would have to get drunk to kind of let down their inhibitions in order to have that much enjoyment. And I was like, no, like he makes a conscious choice to do that. And he does it every single party. And so I just remember kind of laughing to myself, like, yeah, he got another person. Like he just converted somebody to the army.
Yeah, look, if I could drink, like, you know, I have a relationship where basically I a little bit and I throw up. I can taste it. I don't swallow up, but it's about this much of anything I'm basically hurling. I get it, right? Like, to let down all your guards and just go all in on something, it's like it's great feeling. So I just naturally have just done it my entire life.
One of the latest companies that you guys have done that I think a lot of people are paying attention to is PlayVS. Maybe talk a little bit about kind of how that came together with Delane and how you guys have built it so quickly. I think a lot of people are sitting there saying, like, great idea. Delane is obviously speaks for himself in terms of how he's been as an entrepreneur, but like this thing has gotten so big so quickly and like how that's come together.
Yeah, look, I mean, I have like goosebumps when I talk about Delane. So, and I think now this week, or the last couple of weeks, you know, I talked to him a lot. You know, he's one of those founders. I met him at South By, right? This goes back to, there's an article I did USA Today this week around like networking and what I'm missing. So this is cool. We caught up a little bit before the Zoom call, but it's not the same as just serendipitously running into people, meeting people. I'm one of those people. I go to every conference. I'm looking to meet people. And a couple of years back at South by Southwest, during there's a side event called Culture House that's put on by just amazing Black entrepreneurs and investors. And it's really kind of this side event that says, look, South by is, you know, mostly white. A lot. And years ago, they said, let's put together this event and Culture House. And so they were serving brisket, which is my favorite from Franklin's, by the way. And my favorite barbecue in the world. You got to go. If you have not been to Franklin's, like, just do it. And I met Delane on the dance floor. And it was a house, and they were serving barbecue. They were playing hip hop, which I love. There was no dance floor per se. I was just really just the only person dancing. And Susie Rue from Cross Culture Fund in LA with Troy Carter introduced me to Delane. Delane was, you know, he grew up in Atlanta. He's a Black kid in Atlanta. Father was murdered before he was born. Grew up was just in the projects. And he was 24 at the time, but just had this like hustle, just like this passion and like sharpness to him that I'll never forget. And we just started talking about esports. And we, you know, it's one of the theses for Science as a fund and investment is what's more entertaining than your phone and Instagram, WhatsApp? It's actually video games. And I thought esports is gonna take off. We just didn't know what it was gonna be. And, you know, I met Delane on the dance floor, as the story goes, and convinced him over the next like 2 months to move out to LA and let's go figure what we should build. So he, on a Friday, dropped everything, Monday moved out to LA. And for a couple months, we kind of figured out that, you know, what are we gonna build? And it ended up PlayVersus, which is a platform for esports in all US high schools and soon to be colleges. If you kind of think about fantasy football, right, which it'll be interesting if we have that this year, but fantasy football is spread across CBS, Yahoo, NFL.com, ESPN, Pro Fantasy Sports, blah, blah. Imagine if there's one service that serviced all fantasy football. That's what PlayVersus is. And so the scale of that, the reason I think people are surprised the speed is globally it's big, US not so much, but you know, one of the things in my back of my head was thinking a little bit ahead. I thought, man, high school football, like how's that gonna be a sport for another decade? I mean, all the data's coming out, the concussions, 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 and the reality is, we're also a sue happy nation. And at some point the liability will probably outweigh the entertainment and the risk, and rightfully so. Esports is gonna be a sport in high schools, and very quickly within the first year, we're rolled out into 23 states where you can play League of Legends, you can play video games essentially that are esports globally in high school, get a letter, win a state championship. And we raised almost $100 million in the first 18 months. And to me, look, at the time, this is, you know, Delane raised the most money any Black founder has ever raised for a consumer internet company in that short amount of time. And this is, you know, special to me. Like, I was born in a refugee camp, right? Like, I grew up very poor. We grew up in a one-bedroom apartment. five kids, seven of us, and, you know, got to the point in life, both my parents were social workers. You know, my mom handed out welfare checks for 25 years. And so I understand different levels of poverty. He grew up in the projects, way tougher neighborhood. I grew up in a very tough neighborhood. His was worse. And so, but I grew up with a father. He didn't. That to me is, you know, a lot of it is him. He is grown as an individual. He is a CEO of a company that is going to be most likely the biggest investment and biggest company that we've ever been a part of, for sure. And so why did it grow so fast? He's an animal. He's just lights out. He will impress anybody. Two, market timing. And then it turns out in this pandemic, when schools are closed, esports, video games, look at the stocks of every video game company in the world right now. It has been up into the right, and kind of going into, hopefully when we reopen schools, contact sports and things that where you're near and close to people, probably not so much. Esports, whatever you think about it, as an Asian, right? I think about this. What if I told my parents, hey, mom, dad, I got a scholarship to play chess in college. They would be so proud. When you think about esports, 5-on-5, it's the strategy is unbelievable. You are thinking 5, 10, 20 steps ahead. You have to react instantaneously while communicating with four other players on your team. It's actually next level, three-dimensional offense, defense, planning strategically. What do we do in life, in real life, as jobs, as career adults? Strategy, offense, defense, thinking as many steps ahead, whether you're a stock trader, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a manager, you are trying to communicate with your peers. You're trying to grow your company. You're trying to create strategy. To me, it's a life skill. So that's why it's so big.
It's been amazing to watch. And and I've hung out in person with Delane. Everything you just said, you're underselling him, right? I mean, he is the real deal. When I asked people for questions for you before we recorded, the number one question was, how the hell does Peter Pham raise so much money over and over and over again for the companies that he works with? I think you will be the first to say it really comes down to the founders and their vision and kind of what they're building. Outside of that, right? So don't spend a lot of time on that. Yeah. Outside of that, what makes a good fundraise and a bad fundraise process now that you've gone through it so many times and been so successful over the years?
Yeah, numbers put it is that I've probably done, for the science portfolio companies that I'm deeply, deeply involved with, we've raised somewhere like $700 million. The companies that have advised, been helped friends raise, been a part of, whether founder, CEOs, myself, tack on another probably billion. So probably somewhere in the realm of about $2 billion. And that's, it's over a decade or so. And a lot of that is, it turns out to me, it's numbers. So in every round, no matter what, I'm talking to 70, we're talking 70 to 100 people. So lots of no's. So I'm somewhere in the 7,000 no range. It knows or soft knows, quick knows, and I'm going for the no. I'm trying to find the person where time and space just align. Like, I am looking for that investment. I am thinking about that space. I have the dollars to commit at this point. And it turns out the system is pretty inefficient, right? You just have to find the investor in the right moment, in the right frame of time, to get a yes in most cases. The most important part of this is the story. So countless times is, and I think my superpower and the skills, I can take most ideas, most pitches, and just reframe it and tell the story in a different way that will be more compelling. You have to remember this investor, I think I can empathize, which is they want to be part of the journey. Like, what's the hook to make them feel like they're almost an employee of the company, like, so where they want to be excited to work for this company? That is the missing link. The other is what we call FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. What are the things where it's obvious things are happening and the momentum's starting to happen? And if I don't get you to come on now, you're going to miss out. So it's framing the story and the information and the data, and every stage is different. So I'll be more practical. Super early, I have an idea. At idea phase, it is really kind of, I call it three phases of every pitch. What was the world before? What, how did the world look before? Before iPhones, before 4G, before Google Maps, right? What exists now that allows what you're doing? What's changed essentially? So if you look at Dollar Shave Club, well, what changed was like subscription. I can mail things, right? Using media postal service mail for like $2. I could ship everything all over the United States for very inexpensively. I can now create and get things from Asia here much, much cheaper. It's just easier, right? I can now email market. I can reach people on Facebook. I can reach people on YouTube. That's what's different, right? Liquid Death, what's different? Instagram, people love sharing, right? People don't drink as much plastic. So like what in the world around us has changed to allow you to succeed? And then what are you doing differently than anybody? So basically, what do you know that I don't know and the world, the rest of the world doesn't know that's special? So those are kind of the things, like what did the world look like before? What does the world look like today? And what are you doing to take advantage of that? And what's the world gonna look like? That's kind of like the story hierarchy of any startup. And I think if you just thought through that a little bit and get to the story quickly, right? I call it cocktail conversations. Whoever you're telling the story to, whether or not they're the decision making or saying yes, they have to articulate that very quickly in a sound bite and remember and something memorable to somebody. It could be their spouse, it could be their colleague, it could be their partner, it could be their friend group. Because a lot of investors, most investors want some validation that they're not absolutely insane for doing this, right? So a lot of times the complicated story is too complicated. So what is different? Why now? Why are you different? Distilled down to a very simple story. And then the last would be, I have this kind of plan. Once you start growing, no matter the phase, seed, A, B, C, D, I can't believe I'm talking. I rarely don't talk about this publicly. Okay. For the 30 days, for the 90 days leading up to the fundraise, okay, kind of go backwards. For the next 30 days, as a founder and CEO, you have 20, 40, 50 things you're trying to get accomplished. Focus everything down to three things that you know you can move the needle and make it go up into the right. What are those three things? And it's not always this top line cumulative revenue. People think revenue, it's not revenue. It's percentages. What's the percentage of people renewing? What's the percentage of people coming back? What is the conversion percentage? What is the average order in the cart going up by? So it's showing that things are getting better, right? So as an investor, I want to know, whoever gave you money last time, did you learn and did you grow, right? Were you efficient with that capital? Because when I come in to invest, I kind of want to, in a way, feel like, well, I'm taking advantage of the last investor. Like they put in all the hard money. Mine's the easy money, right? So you have to prove that the money that you took, here's what I did, here's what I learned. And it's starting to happen. These things are really like, we learned a lot. We took the last investor's money, learned a ton, and now really starting to ramp. And I'm gonna take your money and increase that ramp. And so, no matter what the startup, you can have and see that data. So we have the company Pray.com. So with all this lockdown stuff, churches are closed. So Pray.com is subscription content, similar to Calm and Headspace, but all based on religion. So what would investors care about? Well, not just new subscribers. Are they listening to more content on each time? Are they converting from download to paid, right? Are more logging in? Are the more sharing it? Essentially velocity, velocity, velocity. You want to find things where you're seeing an uptick in a percentage uptake, because top line revenue to me can be bought. In any startup, give me $10 million, I'll buy $10 million revenue. That's very inefficient. What you want to show is for every dollar that comes in, I'm making things faster, creating more efficiency in the product. the consumer love for it, since I do a consumer, show me for fact that people love the damn thing. Well, 25 random people getting tattoos, people getting married with it, people, I think we saw 500,000 posts so far on Instagram, 500,000 about Lipida. Well, that tells you people truly, authentically love it, right? Oh, and by the way, it's been in Whole Foods now for 2 months. It's now outperforming vitamin water. It's out, you know, we're seeing acceleration every week, week over week, more and more cases being sold. So then if I extrapolate that out as an investor, I say, whoa, okay, so if I give you money and there's more distribution, you're going to keep growing. So it's all about storytelling, right? But when you look at the details of the data, pick three things that you're going to focus on as a founder and CEO and drive those things and tell a story of why there's correlation and causation, that these things are important for the future of the company. And it always comes down to cohorts. And if you don't know what the word cohort means, look it up, right? Like the customers that came in this week versus the customers next week versus the customers, like follow the journey of those customers and show that the customers that came in last month versus this month, everything's getting better, right? There's logging in more often. Their average order is higher. Like Amazon, take a big company. Amazon Prime, well, how many, not just how many people are Amazon Prime members, but how many renewed? How are they spending more month after month after month? Is it worth launching this other thing? Well, yes, if they spend more money, right? Velocity, velocity, velocity. I'm sure as like most people, the number of boxes showing up at your front desk door is increasing, not decreasing in time. So, well, that means they're doing better. Take that same example and take it to your startup. There's always something that's getting better. If it's not, it's probably not working. Like if you can't find anything in the data that shows that there's some velocity happening, even a small number, even if you, I don't care if you have 100 or 1,000 users, something has to be picking up steam. If it's not, time to move on, time to change ideas, time to change strategies, biz. Because even in a small sample, you will find something that's interesting if it's working.
And so that's like the founder perspective, right? Of like what they can actually drive. And you mentioned the kind of 90 days pre actually going out for the fundraise. That's about 30 days of focus. What do you do in the other 60 days?
Well, the next 30 days is the 30 days of focus, 30 days of it actualizing, right? It's working. Things are going up and to the right. The last 30 days is during the fundraise. During the fundraise, it's continuing to go up. It's something, if I talk to you today on Monday, when you check back in on Thursday, it got better. When you check in next week, it's better. You as an investor start feeling like, oh, like the trends, it keeps going. I might miss out if I don't jump on, right? I have the saying called linear is flat, right? If your data just goes linear, as an investor, why would I invest now? When I can wait, when I know where it's going to be next month, why would I invest now, right? If I know where it's going to be 3 months, meaning, let me give you an example. Hey, we're growing one customer a month, or 1 million a month. So it's June, so in December, you'll be 6 more million, right? And then a year from now, it'll be 12 more million. 2 years from now, well, I can just wait, pay more later, but de-risk. De-risk by 95+% of my dollar risk, right? Because risk as an investor means where are they going to be next month, 6 months? That's where all the risk is. I want to invest if I think that I don't know, like it's just going up and maybe in 6 months it doesn't go up to $6 million, right? It goes to 24 or 30. So when you start finding the things to work on, it can't be this linear growth. It has to take this, you know, hockey stick. People think about the hockey stick. I know it sounds so easy. It's not. It is finding data that shows hockey stick. So as an investor, day first 30 days, focus. Next 30 days, it's starting to happen. The next 30 days, it continues to happen so that in those investor conversations, you're honest about it. You're not, right? You look at the data, but there's something to talk about continuously, and it keeps going up. And hey, investor, if you give me money, I can make this even go faster. That's to me kind of like the 90-day program. It is about, because look, as a founder and CEO, there's so many false positives in your data. There's so many false negatives in your data. Taking the time to kind of distill it down to three things that move the needle, that fundamentally answer the question, is this a good idea? Is this working? This is going to be big. Takes this like exercise of just pulling things apart and ignoring the noise, because what I've always found is startups who do too many things always fail. Like you can be great at one thing. Like until you have scale against one thing, don't do the second and third idea. Like it's Uber took a long time before they did Uber Eats, like a long time, right? So that's after like billions in the coffers. Most startups, before you raise 100 million, you're doing one thing for a very long time. And so a lot of this exercise is just saying, as a CEO, you have 20 ideas and people working on, distill it down a little bit and you'll find more velocity, more truth to your startup. And then you, when you go talk to investors, it's much easier to digest as well.
And I think that we are glossing over one of the most important facts, because you and I take it as an obvious thing, but it's really about the experimentation, right? A lot of people, I think, kind of early on, and especially the first or second company that they go to build, it's all about like, I know for a fact this is going to work. And investors, if they're good at anything, like they see right through that. And what you're really describing here is this idea of, hey, I'm running an experiment. That experiment is, you give me dollars, here's what I think I can accomplish. I come back to you in, you know, 6-12 months, and I say, hey, those dollars you gave me, I hit 4 of the 5 things I thought I was going to hit. Give me more money. Here's the next 6 that I'm going to go hit, right? It's kind of this almost tranched bucket of accomplishments. And I think what you're really saying is like, you have to almost understand what those possibilities are and what you've actually been successful doing in order to tell the story, right?
Yeah. And I think it's good exercise for the founder to like really understand what's happening. I think I'm always surprised when I talk to founders about their company and ideas, when I say, hey, what about this data? What is the consumer? Walk me through the consumer journey and tell me what's getting better and why do you think that is? And we always say data, data, data. It's not about just showing graphs, right? It's about articulating why. Like, why do you think that's happening? And can you replicate that over and over and over? And your defensibility, ultimately, as a company, everything can be replicated. Like, there will be clones everywhere. But those that understand the why always win, right? The why, the secret sauce is the thing people invest in. Because ultimately, whatever you are, you can be copied. We've seen this happen in every startup that's out there. Because of the speed of the internet and Twitter and Crunchbase, and Quora and you name it, there's no like secret, right? That's too hard to replicate. This is just water in a can. The secret, right, is what Mike Cesare, the founder, has in his head, and has how he creates the culture and how he thinks about his fan base and how he thinks the next thing he's gonna do that emboldens and really grows that passion of those users to use that voice. And so you have to understand the why and how to replicate that over and over again and spend the time on the data to see it and look at it in different perspectives. And so, yeah, there's every startup, you wanna be either number one or number two in the market. There's never number three, right? And so being number one, usually you can get by being first. Number two actually works too by fast follow, but you also just have to understand why. So Uber, Lyft examples, et cetera. Dollar Shave Club and Harry's was the other example. Dog Vacay and Rover, they actually end up merging. There will always be two in any market, but one typically pulls completely away from the other. And typically it's because they understand the customer. Look, Airbnb, HomeAway was first, then Airbnb. But Airbnb actually understood the customer better, the younger demographic, the millennial, you know, whatever you want to call it, and the flexibility, and they pulled away. So to me, understanding the insights and the human psychology of why people talk about things, why people share on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and the tools that you give them. To a lot of times, you look at big brands, they're fearful of somebody else taking that brand and altering it. Remember the days when like every brand would be offended if they saw like their logo on somebody, a user who just like took it and changed it? That you want your consumers to take it and like make it their own version of it, right? That's why Supreme took off. If you can think about like culture, is the other people took something and like made it different, made it personal, made it individualism to some degree. Today you have to allow that. Like you have to allow people to express themselves and feel like they own part of that idea. Otherwise you'll fail. So, you know, I think about consumers. Enterprise is much different. I did enterprise for a very long time. That one's fascinating, but I enjoy consumer stuff.
What are the areas in consumer that you're most excited about right now, or that you guys are looking at saying, hey, somebody's going to go build a company in X vertical, and if you're working on it, come talk to Science.
So we have a company. It's interesting. We announced the fundraising right before the pandemic, and it's called Arrive Outdoors. And there's two, actually. Arrive Outdoors, we rent camping gear. So the thesis then was, well, you know, everyone's Marie Kondoing their lives, everyone's getting rid of stuff, but everybody wants experiences. And so we rent premium, like the highest end camping gear, but we ship it to you nationwide. Pandemic hits, everything shuts down. We're like, oh, but guess what? The last couple of weeks, what does everyone want to do? Camping. Parks, national, we have the exclusive with almost every state park, national park. So you can go to Arrive Outdoors right now. We'll send you clean, cleansed, sterilized, like camping equipment for you to use. When you're done, shove it in a box, send it back to us. We'll clean it and sterilize it for the next customer. That, like, so what is that? That's the behavior part. So what does the world look like 6 to 12 months from now? When we started that one, we thought, well, you know, nobody has stores, nobody has garages, everyone wants to do the experiences. They want to do it with different people. They want to do different places. So if I camp where it's hot versus where it rains for 4 people, where it's 8 people, it's like different gear. You're not going to collect all this stuff, but you also want the nice stuff, the stuff that's, you know, like the high-end things that aren't going to break down, the high-end things that are the nicest materials that keep you warm. And now it's just interesting. We got timing is everything, right? Like we also are hitting this time where everyone wants to be outdoors. That's the types of behaviors. Lambs is another one. It's interesting, like, I think universally, most people would not want to hold their phone against their head all day, right? Now, whether you believe it actually causes cancer or not, it's less about that. It's that maybe we don't know enough. It may just turn out that just like tobacco was supposed to be okay with for us, and sugar was okay for us, and you know, Teflon was okay for us. Maybe like cell phones and Wi-Fi. I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but maybe. So why wouldn't you protect yourself? So Lambs, right? You can buy radiation-proof underwear, hats, beanies. We have this thing called the snapback glove. It's a silver-lined glove that you kind of slide in your hand to open up doors, so you don't have to touch it. But the brand is really about like protective clothing that, you know, it's nice, it works, it's comfortable. Why wouldn't you wear this underwear if you're trying to get pregnant or you actually think, you know, maybe it does cause cancer? So so the new stuff, you know, we're launching a cereal. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that yet, but we're launching a cereal brand. I think about launching brands that are unexpected. This one's amazing. And she's one of those people, you know, I think creativity, when we think about brands, a lot of it will be the founder, the creativity, and something that is worth talking about. When I think about experiences that are utilizing what's changed, so we're thinking about how to not just regular homeschooling. So for everybody who's got kids on Zoom, what's the product that they might be liking? Meetings, so we're incubating something around that. We're doing music. I mean, we have a record label, and we're hip hop and trap music. So, you know, there's, to me, entertainment is still a big part of what we think about wanting to do. And Wishbone and Yarn are two top 200 apps in the App Store, right? That's us. And that's just people want to be entertained. Short form stories, people want to, it's quizzes. You'll see this big announcement we're doing in a couple of days with one of the big platforms. You know, ultimately we get lots of inbound. The ideas we want to see are, if it's a brand, what's different? Like, tell me, why are people going to talk about it, right? If it's experiential services like an Arrive Outdoors or Dog Vacay was, where fundamentally it's a different way to do something through a service, why and how does it scale? And then third, entertainment, if it's an app or if it's like esports, Playversus or Prey.com, like that to me is a something to do on your mobile device that's not Instagram, that's not Facebook, that's not Snapchat. So what is that thing? You know, right now it's we have Wishbone, Yarn, Prey.com, Playversus. So it's a lot of these ideas for us are, I know it when I see it. My partners know it when they see it, and it's a lot of gut. You know, parent, like, do we believe, you know, Realblox is a company that when I saw, I said, do we believe DocuSign is the last thing we'll ever see in digitization of an asset? Like that's a crazy, right? So we all, I'm sure, own Bitcoin. We all understand the value of creating digital assets. And Realblox is looking at taking real world big bank assets, REITs, securities, and then taking that whole automation of the back end of it, the idea of putting that in digital form and making it globally accessible. It's gonna happen, whether it's today, tomorrow. There's no doubt, there isn't a rational person in the world that would say, like, at some point, isn't it crazy that if you love the Tesla stock, if I'm in some country, like name it, like I'm in Vietnam, like how do I buy Tesla stock on the NASDAQ? Like I can't do that unless I have an account with Chase Citibank. Like, no, that's not the way the world's gonna work. And so globalization of assets, as you know, Science was one of the few Reg D tokens that was ever created. And to us, that was a tremendous learning of how hard it is, right, to do. And so, you know, we're still working on a bunch of crazy ideas, right? We have Protego launching soon, which is a custody and a trust company. And we're one of the only things that exist in the world that you can take any assets and put it in custody. It could be your house, it could be Bitcoin, it could be any assets. I like thinking the world in that manner, where what's it going to be in a year to 2 years? I'm not a 5-year person, 10, that's telling the future. To me, 12 to 18 months is not about, like, I'm smart. It's observing the relevant information at hand today. Like, Arrive is like, well, people want to camp. People don't want to own things. Like, to tell you that story that in a year, people are going to rent a lot of camping gear wasn't a stretch. You know, plastic bottles, people don't drink. We ban plastic straws. To think that water in a can might take 1 year isn't too big of a stretch. And so I'm much more that's been my skill as an investor, 12 to 18 months, maybe 2 years. 10 years, we can have opinions on. I don't want to wait that long to know if I'm right. That's my skill. And I want to have fun. I want to love the founder. I want that founder to have a relationship with me that's just a lot different and much truer. But I'm all in. Like, this doesn't work for me, right? Like, I know you don't work. Like, it's not work when you love what you do. And it's like, we wake up to do these things. That's what I did.
My one thing that I think I've learned from you is, you were talking earlier about kind of telling the story. And I think one thing that people don't realize that you do probably better than anyone I've ever seen is you practice. I've heard you literally pitch Liquid Death probably 500 times while I'm with you, two people, as you're handing the can. And it was all before that, the big last fundraise, right? And so, like, all of that repetition, every time wasn't exactly the same. But it went from, hey, there's this water in this can that, you know, was kind of what I would assume most people would start at, to by the time the 500th time I heard you say it, I was like, damn, that's pretty compelling. Like, there's not that many people who are going to say no to that.
Well, the funny thing is you say practice, but my whole life, I've never, when I do talks, I don't write them down. It's always off the cuff. It drives people nuts, but I don't, it's mostly because I have a really bad memory. Like diagnosed with ADHD, bottom 16th percentile memory. It's just the pitch, it's adjustments based on people's reaction, right? And I just adjust. So when I say 7,000 no's, those 7,000 no's got to a couple hundred yeses, just because every time I'm just watching the reaction, I'm listening to the reaction. What do they have questions about? How can I essentially in advance answer the question in the pitch? So part of pitching is repetition. You can call it practice, but talking it out loud to people, normal people like Gen Pop who aren't investors, do they understand what you're telling? Then through the lens of an investor, every time you get the question, like, I don't know why this? If you can weave in your narrative the answer before the questions are going to come, what you want is a dialogue where you do a pitch for 5 minutes and the rest is just like conversation, not questions, because you've answered all these things like why now, why this, you know, why now, why would this work? I don't understand. If you tell your pitch in a way by kind of answering those questions along, you don't waste that 30 minutes you have with an investor. I always think, even though people say it, it's an hour, you really have, in my opinion, you have about 15 minutes, like, you know, maybe less. So you got to capture them inside the first few minutes, 15 minutes. A meeting that goes longer than 1 hour, you have them. The last thing I'll say is there's a 24-hour rule I have. If an investor doesn't call you, text you, message you, hell, even like a tweet of yours, within 24 hours, it's a no. Move on. Fast no's is all I've ever asked for my investors. Like, I'm not offended if you pass. Like, if it's not your thing, it's not your thing. What's the worst is slow no's, because you're just, it's like hope. To an entrepreneur, you're giving them hope, and that sucks. Like, just cut it so they can move on. Like, they need to move on. And so if you're an entrepreneur out there and you're pitching people, if they haven't gotten back to you in a week, don't bother. Like, don't waste energy hoping, right? And you're not a teacher. You are not, as an entrepreneur, built to educate everybody. So just because an investor asked the question does not mean you have to answer. It is not truth serum. Like, it is amazing when founders are like, I told them this, I'm like, why would you tell them everything? Like, they're not on the board. They're not an investor. That is information only for us. And so remember the power dynamics is that I never say things like we're raising money. I don't like to say that, right? And when I talk to investor, I'm talking about we're looking for people who can be a part of this, right? Would you like the privilege to invest? Like, make it feel like it's a privilege. Like, they have to sell you a little bit. And it's a really mental thing. It's in the back of your head. If anybody out there who's raised money before, the moment you get somebody, you get a term sheet, all of a sudden you are so much more confident to the next investor. Nothing actually changed, right? Except your confidence into that next pitch. And all of a sudden, like, the momentum of the close happens. If you've ever raised money, take that feeling and try to pitch like that all the time. Pitch with confidence, not arrogance. There's a big difference. Don't pitch with arrogance. I hate that. Pitch with confidence that you're looking for somebody to be a part of this, that it should be, rightfully so, if you're building a company that's going to be worth more money, they are lucky to be investing, right? It's this relationship where you're saying, look, if you give us dollars, I'm in return going to make you more money. The desperation thing never works. It's a really interesting dynamic in a psychology thing when raising money, that your shares and equity of the company is very, very valuable. Treat it like so, because if you treat it like it's not, why would an investor want to give you money if you don't even think it's valuable? So It's the subtleties. It's a lot of subconsciousness around that.
Every great entrepreneur knows that the investor needs them in order to make a return on the fund. Where can people find you on the internet and find out more about Science if they want to get in touch with you guys?
I'm a Twitter guy, at Peter Pham. My Twitter is really, it is, if you follow me, it is, there's no agenda. It is, it's diarrhea. It just falls out. Like, it's just, you should strike that word. It basically is my emotion. I wear it on my sleeve. It's no bull. It's no BS. I definitely, my PR firm tells me I shouldn't be tweeting so much about things, but Twitter, it's my true self. I really don't look for validation. I am who I am. I have confidence in what I'm doing. And so Twitter's the best. Hit me up. My DMs are open. I read everything. If I don't reply, you know, sometimes it does get buried. Email as well, but science-inc.com, info@, we read everything. All the partners open up every email. So we do reply. And I would say, as we look through the trying times right now, I will say we are proud. We're very diverse in our investments. We have a lot of women. We have a lot of Black founders. And I think that's a subset of being in LA more than anything else. Like, that's just what we grew up with. We don't have Stanford grads down here. No offense to Stanford, I suppose, if I say that. And it just has to resonate. We don't ever take offense to investors that don't, you know, that say no. It's just timing. Serendipity is so much of this. How many investments have you done where it was serendipity meeting?
Most of them. Yeah. I don't know the exact percentage, but definitely most of them. In the sense of, and some of it too is, if you look back, some of it is you know people who are doing the deal and they think of you because of something that you did or said in the past, and they just say, hey, I know you're interested in this. Some of it is founders who say, like, I specifically want you to come do this and here's how you can be helpful. And then some of it is like going and looking for things, right? So there's no like one single bucket, but most of it, if you look back, you kind of laugh at like how it came together. But hey, it works.
I know. At the end of the day, not every startup's going to work out. Like, we have to just be real. And I've had my failures. Everybody's had their failures. It is a numbers game. And I always start back from zero. Like, it's who cares what you did in the past? Like, the now, right? And so I always have this mentality, like, I have to work hard. I got to try. I got to make the effort and put it in. And I think as an investor, things that burned you in the past, don't let it really, really hinder your investments in the future. Like, that's a big, big lesson. It's kind of like we're talking about the stock market. How many stocks right now, if you look at it, you owned way earlier, then you sold, and then it went up, and you're like, oh, it's too expensive. And now it's twice as much now, or three times as much now. Like, right. I bought my Tesla 200 and something, sold at 7 something, thinking I was a hero. So it's gonna hit 1,000. I'll probably still buy more because I am actually long Tesla or whatever the stock is. Right, Amazon is the stock I'll buy forever. And so if you look at investments, one of the biggest lessons right now, even as early, is if you love the company and the idea and the founder, and it got too expensive last time. You know, if your thesis as a fund will allow it, you should still probably invest, or at least personally invest, because great companies stay great usually. And so, yeah, it is
spoken
hard,
like the ultimate fundraiser. I love it.
That's right. So you can still call me, and we're raising money for a lot of things. We're actually, you know, we're raising our next fund right now. And it's like, to me, I love that we are allowed to do this. It's a privilege. Are you kidding me? How lucky are we? I'm never, ever, ever forgetful and how lucky I am to do this job. Like, so you got to pay attention. You got to put the work in, right? Like LPs give me money, expecting returns. I better be hustling for it. So, but it's fun.
You are an absolute legend. I appreciate you doing this. I couldn't speak more highly of you guys over at Science. So any founders who are listening to this, please, please, please go reach out to them because they got the receipts, man. They know how to build companies.
Oh, just wait. That's the thing. That's what kills me. You know, you ever sit there and think, God, and it's, you know, the fast forward part, I can't wait till next year. Like, the things that are happening that you know, and that's the, I think on the inside for me, having the studio part and the fund is like, we have different perspective. I have a different lens on all my investments, right? As a fund investor, when I'm investing into Liquid Death, well, I know more than any investor. Like they started in our offices, right? And so it's, it's too hard to articulate because it's just too much information. That to me is everything. Like we all as human beings, just want to be right. Right? Like at our core, we just want to be right. And I know and I can admit that. So people are saying my bias is like, you're only posting data that fit your narrative. Of course I am. Like that's that's human nature, right? So, but yeah, just, I'm so excited for some of these companies right now that hopefully it'll work, right? Glass is always half full for me. It's never, like to live in that other side, I don't understand. Like, it's just so sad. It's so sad.
I couldn't agree more. We are going to have to do this again for sure when this stuff comes to fruition. Cause I think that, the things you guys are working on are always awesome, but you guys have definitely done a fantastic job kind of navigating all the recent chaos. So thank you again for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for having me, man. Since Joe Rogan is 100 million, what are you going to go for? Come on.
But please, Joe has a 14-year head start on everybody else. That's what people forget is he's been doing this since
internet time. You'll be there. Oh, fine. You'll get there in like 4.
No comment.
I know.
All right, man.
All right. Peace out, man.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening to that episode. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. My goal is to educate as many people with these conversations as possible. So please go subscribe on your favorite podcast channel, leave a 5-star rating, and a review. These things really help the podcast get higher up on the popularity charts, which ultimately brings more people to learn. Also, don't forget you can go to YouTube to watch each conversation in video format as well. Just search my name, Anthony Pompliano, on YouTube, and you'll find our channel with hundreds of awesome and informative videos. Thanks again for listening to this one, and I'll see you for the next one.